Welcome, you curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're plunging into a topic that combines, intense urgency with incredible precision. Emergency anesthesia and intubation. Think of it as the ultimate high-stakes performance, often happening in the most challenging environments imaginable.
Absolutely. And it's really not just about putting someone to sleep, is it? It's a critical, often life-saving intervention.
Right.
Our source material today is a comprehensive standard operating procedure from LRM. It's a really detailed guide for pre-hospital and inter-hospital settings.
Okay.
And what's fascinating, I think, is how it lays out this defined, standardized approach, you know, from drug choices to equipment layout.
Mm-hmm.
But it also meticulously details the crucial moments where you must diverge from that standard.
So our mission here is to extract those vital nuggets of knowledge from this incredibly detailed protocol.
Mm-hmm.
We want to help you understand not just the what and how, but really the profound why behind one of the most important and, potentially dangerous procedures in emergency medicine. We're asking, how do you standardize precision when you're facing absolute chaos? Let's get into it. So our sources state that pre-hospital rapid sequence induction, or RSI, is a defining skill for pre-hospital physicians.
That's right.
And even probably the most important intervention we perform. But then it also calls it one of the most dangerous. That sounds like a stark paradox.
It really does.
What makes it so inherently critical yet so risky?
Well, what's fascinating here is precisely that dual nature. You know, RSI is fundamentally about securing an airway fast to save a life, especially when a patient just can't protect their own airway.
Okay.
But the very medications and procedures we use carry significant physiological risks, particularly in patients whose bodies are already unstable, barely compensating.
Right. They're already on the edge.
Exactly. The LRM document emphasizes it's only for those with appropriate experience and really rigorous training. It requires repeated mental and practical rehearsal.
You just wing it.
No, absolutely not. Its SOP is designed to be simple and standard every single time, precisely to reduce that cognitive load, that stress, in those incredibly high-pressure, chaotic situations. It's trying to remove as much variability as possible from a volatile environment.
Okay, so the goal is standardization, clear steps. But as you mentioned, our guide immediately highlights important exceptions.
Yes.
And this feels crucial because in an emergency, knowing when to stick to the script versus when to follow a different but still predefined script, that could be the difference between life and death.
Absolutely critical distinction.
So let's unpack some of these critical scenarios where the usual plan needs that sharp pivot.
Yeah, and this raises a really important question for any medical professional. You know, when is standard not standard? The LRM document outlines several key situations. First, in cardiac arrest, and that includes traumatic cardiac arrest, induction agents, the drugs to put someone to sleep, and muscle relaxants are not indicated.
Okay, none of those.
None. Here, the priority is immediate airway control and resuscitation. Intubation needs to happen without delay, often by a paramedic, actually. That frees up the physician for other urgent stuff like thoracostomy.
A chest procedure, right?
A life-saving procedure to relieve pressure around the lungs. And crucially, in this really dire scenario, the typical pre-intubation checklist isn't required. Time is just absolutely of the essence.
That makes perfect sense. No time for drugs when the heart stopped. You need manual interventions, stat.
Yeah.
What about patients who are still alive, but, you know, critically unstable, crashing right before your eyes?
Yeah, for those crashing or critically unstable patients, the speed bomb checklist, and we'll definitely get to that in a moment, is used.
Okay.
But, and this is key, the doses of induction agents are greatly reduced. For very unstable patients with a low GCS, our measure of consciousness.
Glasgow coma scale.
Exactly. Only a muscle relaxant might be given.
Yeah.
The key thing here is that these patients are often totally dependent on their sympathetic tone, their body's natural fight or flight response, just to maintain their blood pressure.
Got it.
Induction agents can just knock that out, causing a catastrophic drop in blood pressure. So in these cases, less medication is often much, much safer.
I can imagine you need a completely different approach again for someone who's, say, agitated or combative, maybe a head injury, severe pain. You can't just RSI them if they're fighting you.
Precisely. For agitated or combative patients, the immediate priority actually shifts. It becomes about safely facilitating positioning, getting monitors on, pre-oxygenation.
Right. Setting the stage first.
Exactly. And here, ketamine has highlighted as a primary agent. It's given in these titrated boluses, maybe 10, 20 milligram at a time.
Small doses.
Small doses. And it provides excellent analgesia, so pain relief and sedation, while largely maintaining respirations and airway tone. Mm. That's incredibly valuable. However, the source does caution careful titration, especially in hypovolemic, meaning low blood volume or hypotensive patients. Even ketamine, while generally safer in shock, needs to be respected.
Okay. So the drugs themselves are obviously a major part of this deep dive. Our sources are very specific about what to use and, maybe more interestingly, what to avoid.
Definitely.
What's the preferred drug regimen for LRM in these high-stakes situations?
LRM primarily uses ketamine and rocuronium. Ketamine is almost the exclusive induction drug.
The main one.
Yeah. Its dose, as we just talked about, depends heavily on the patient's hemodynamic status. The document specifically notes its safety for adult and pediatric head injuries. It causes minimal ICP, intracranial pressure, increase, but maintains cerebral perfusion pressure, CPP.
Which is blood flow to the brain, vital.
Vital distinction, yeah. However, caution is advised for patients with ischemic heart disease because it can affect heart rate and blood pressure.
Makes sense. And what about the paralytic agent, the drug that relaxes the muscles for intubation?
So rocuronium is the preferred muscle relaxant in pre-hospital settings.
Why rocuronium over others, like succinylcholine?
Good question. Its longer duration of paralysis is actually considered more useful than succinylcholine because pre-hospital patients aren't likely to be extubated within just a few hours.
Right, or you're usually going to an ICU.
Exactly. And that prolonged relaxation can also critically aid rescue airway techniques if the initial intubation attempt fails. Mm-hmm. It gives the team valuable time to manage a difficult airway.
Okay, that's a really practical point. I saw fentanyl mentioned in the protocol, too. Is that a regular part of the mix or used more selectively?
Fentanyl is used more selectively in specific targeted situations. For instance, in isolated head injury patients.
Okay.
It's given slowly, the idea being to make it effective right at the time of intubation. But you have to watch carefully for respiratory depression. It's also considered for stable patients with confirmed or suspected intracranial hemorrhage, ischemic heart disease, or maybe cerebral or aortic aneurysm dissection, particularly during interfacility transfers. The goal there is blunting the stress response of intubation, which can be really beneficial in those cases.
And what about propofol? I feel like you hear that name a lot in anesthesia contexts. Is it used here?
This is a critical point the LRM protocol makes.
Yeah.
Propofol is largely de-emphasized for emergency RSI.
Really? Why is that?
The primary reason is the high risk of hypotension. A significant drop in blood pressure, particularly in hemodynamically compromised patients. The risk of just worsening their condition, making them crash, is often too high.
Okay.
It is appropriate for some specific other indications, like status epilepticus, or maybe hemodynamically stable overdose patients, or hypertensive intracerebral bleeds where actually lowering the blood pressure might be desirable.
Ah, okay. Specific scenario.
Very specific. But the rule is clear. It should not be used for hypovolemic or shocked patients.
Got it. So it's not just what drugs, but how much and when. Our sources detail specific dosing protocols. It recognizes that one size definitely does not fit all here.
No, absolutely not.
What are the main scenarios for adjusting these potent drug doses?
The document provides three key scenarios, really acknowledging the diverse physiological states you encounter. First, there's the standard induction. This covers the majority of pre-hospital and in-hospital RSIs.
Your typical RSI, if there is such a thing.
Sort of, yeah. For that, it's ketamine 1.5 milligilobin and rocuronium 1.5 milligilograms, potentially up to 2 milligilograms. And it's vital to consider if the patient has already received other sedatives or opiates because that will influence the dose you need.
Right, need to factor that in. And for those patients who are in a really precarious state, the hemodynamically compromised ones.
For patients with actual hemodynamic compromise, this is crucial. You reduce the ketamine dose significantly, down to 0.5 milligilograms, or maybe even less if they are profoundly shocked.
Wow, that's a big reduction.
It is. And again, the rationale is that these patients depend on their body's sympathetic tone to keep going. Even ketamine can reduce that. However, and this is important, you do not reduce the dose of the paralytic, the rocuronium.
Keep the paralytic dose the same.
Keep it the same. Full paralysis is still needed for optimal intubating conditions. In rare, really extreme cases, the document notes that only the paralyzing agent might be given, just to secure the airway without further compromising their already failing circulation.
That sounds like a very delicate balance, getting the sedation right without making things worse. What about a specific trauma type, like that isolated head injury example?
Exactly. For a truly isolated head injury, they use that vivid example of someone kicked in the head by a horse.
Yeah, memorable.
It is. The protocol suggests fentanyl at 1.5 millinewt kilograms given slowly and early during the preparation phase.
Okay, fentanyl first.
Fentanyl first, then followed by the standard ketamine, 1.5 millinewt kilogram, and rocuronium, 1.5 millinewt kilograms. The fentanyl here helps blunt that stress response from the intubation itself, which could otherwise spike intracranial pressure.
Okay, so a tailored approach even within head injuries. Now, the intubation itself is just the beginning, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Our source highlights the critical importance of post-intubation care. It's not just about getting the tube in place, but maintaining the patient safely afterwards. What happens next?
Yeah, a key takeaway here, and it's a fundamental ethical and medical principle the document explicitly states. Never allow a patient to remain paralyzed with inadequate analgesia and sedation.
Cannot emphasize that enough.
Absolutely non-negotiable. For ongoing infusions, common agents include morphine and midazolam, or perhaps fentanyl and midazolam, tailored to the patient's needs and condition.
And if continued paralysis is needed, maybe for ventilator synchrony or managing a severe head injury.
For ongoing paralysis, rocuronium is maintained. The protocol suggests doses like 0.6 millimeter kilograms for the first maintenance dose around 20 minutes, then 0.3 millimeters every 30 minutes after that.
Very specific.
Very specific. It even specifies average adult doses, 50 milligrams at 20 minutes, then 25 milligrams every 30 minutes. And a vital practical tip, especially for high-pressure environments like in flight, is meticulous organization. All syringes must be clearly labeled. And they mentioned using something called a Grid-It to organize RSI syringes, preventing errors when things get jostled or time is incredibly short.
That makes sense. Organization equals safety when things are moving fast. Speaking of organization, when every second counts, having equipment ready and a clear plan is vital. Our sources detail the kit dump and the speed bomb checklists. These sound like exactly what you'd need to bring order to chaos.
They really are. The kit dump is all about the standardized, meticulous layout of equipment. It might change slightly based on the environment, the patient, the urgency.
Right.
But the core idea is having everything arranged intuitively, immediately accessible.
Muscle memory for your kit.
Exactly. Developing that muscle memory for where every critical piece of equipment lives.
And the speed bomb checklists, that's a memorable acronym. It sounds like a rigorous process.
The speed bomb checklists are absolutely essential. They're mandated for all RSIs in this protocol, and importantly, should be practiced daily in RSI drills.
Daily practice? Wow.
Yes. They use a strict challenge and response format. You know, one person calls out the item, the other confirms it's ready. This is designed to avoid errors and delays.
Mm-hmm.
There are two main parts acting as critical safety nets.
Okay, let's break them down. Speed bomb one first.
Right. Speed bomb one is the pre-RSI rapid checklist. It ensures absolute readiness across key areas before any drugs are given. It covers suction, confirming two working suction units that critical redundancy.
Two.
Positioning, ensuring manual inline stabilization, MILS, for C-spine protection if needed, and optimal patient positioning. Equipment for intubation, making sure you have two laryngoscopes, your tool for viewing the airway, a bougie, various endotracheal tubes, ETTs, cuff syringe, tube tie, McGill's forceps, and importantly, two oxygen sources ready.
Backups for everything.
Pretty much. Then end-tidal CO2, confirming waveform capnography. That real-time display of exhaled CO2, which is vital for confirming tube placement, is connected to the BVM, the bag valve mask. Drugs and IV access, verifying two IV or IO intraosseous into the bone access points, and that all pre-drawn, clearly labeled drugs are ready. That includes fentanyl, ketamine, rocuronium or succinylcholine, and metaraminol, a vasopressor.
Got it.
Backup airway ready. This is huge. Having a BVM, airway adjuvants like masks or airways, an LMA laryngeal mask airway, a rescue device, and critically, the surgical airway kit out and ready for immediate use. Not just nearby, but out.
Plan B needs to be instantly accessible.
Instantly. Oxygen. Confirm supply to the patient and adequate reserves in the tanks. Monitoring. Ensuring minimums are met. Pulse rate, short interval blood pressure, SpO2, ECG. And finally, briefing. Roles are assigned clearly. Plan A, usually conventional or video laryngoscopy. And plan B, like an LMA or a surgical airway, are discussed out loud. This proactive planning is just invaluable.
That is incredibly comprehensive. A lot to get through before you even push the first drug. Then, once the tube is in, there's another set of vital checks with Speed Bomb 2.
Exactly. That's Speed Bomb 2, the post-RSI rapid checklist. This focuses on securing the endotracheal tube, ETT, confirming its position, checking for equal air entry in both lungs, noting the depth marking at the lips or teeth.
Crucial details.
And ensuring continuous ETCO2 monitoring. It also includes elevating the head of the bed, usually 15-30 degrees, unless there's a reason not to. Administering ongoing drugs, analgesia, sedation, paralysis. Having the BVM readily handy just in case. Ensuring adequate oxygen supply. Inserting an OGT or NGT, a nasogastric tube, to decompress the stomach. Checking the ETT cuff pressure. And continuously monitoring ventilator settings, vital signs, and ideally, blood gases. It's all about comprehensive post-procedure management and maintaining that secure airway.
It really paints a picture of constant vigilance, even after the main event seems over. Now, beyond the main procedure and these checklists, our sources delve into some important debates and specific considerations. Let's talk about cricoid pressure and C-spine protection. These are things you hear about a lot, and sometimes practice evolves.
These are definitely areas where evidence and practice continue to evolve, and the LRM protocol reflects that uncertainty, which is interesting. For cricoid pressure.
Pushing on the neck cartilage, right, to prevent aspiration.
That's the traditional thinking, yeah. But what's fascinating here is that the evidence for its benefit is actually quite lacking.
Really?
Yeah, and it might even interfere with getting a good view for intubation. Mm. So because of that, it's not mandated in LRM practice.
So they don't routinely do it?
Not routinely mandated. Now, if it is used maybe for a patient considered at very high risk of aspiration, the protocol is clear. It must be released immediately if the patient actively vomits, if there's difficulty visualizing the vocal cords, or if a rescue device like an LMA needs to be placed. Patient safety and securing the airway always take precedence over the cricoid pressure itself.
That's a significant departure from maybe older, more traditional teaching. What about protecting the cervical spine, the C spine, especially in trauma where an injury might not be obvious?
Yeah, the clinical implications of intubation on an injured C spine are still debated. Which is, as you say, quite surprising given how important it seems.
You'd think that would be settled science by now.
You would, but it's complex. However, immobilization is clearly indicated for patients with neck pain, neurological symptoms, altered consciousness, or a significant blunt injury above the clavicles. The technique used is manual inline stabilization. Bill List.
So someone holding the head steady.
Exactly. Holding the head and neck steady in a neutral position. The process usually involves applying a soft collar initially, then removing it for the mills during the actual induction and intubation attempt, and then replacing the collar once the ETT is secured.
Oh.
But crucially, just like with cricoid pressure, if you encounter a difficult intubation, or worse, a can't intubate, can't oxygenate scenario where you need to go to a surgical airway, mills may need to be relaxed or even completely released. The airway always, always comes first.
Airway overrides almost everything else in that moment. Finally, it's worth noting the document includes specific guidance for pediatric patients, our smallest and often most vulnerable patients. What's different when dealing with children?
Yeah, that's critical. The core principles obviously remain the same, but the doses and preparations are meticulously detailed for children under 12 years or under 50 kilograms.
Everything's weight-based, I assume.
Everything is weight-based and requires precision. Mm. The document provides options for standardized medication infusions. Morphine, fentanyl, midazolam, rocuronium. These often involve specific dilutions and concentrations adapted for those precise pediatric weight-based guidelines.
Less room for error.
Much less. The critical emphasis is on avoiding both oversedation and insufficient analgesia or sedation. Mm-hmm. That could be a very fine line to walk in children because their physiology is just different. And reinforcing that theme of precision, every single syringe must be meticulously labeled with the agent, the amount, and the final concentration to prevent potentially devastating errors.
Wow. This deep dive has really shown us just how much goes into a procedure that might look, I don't know, straightforward from the outside looking in.
It's anything but straightforward.
The precision, the protocols, the specific drug choices, those exhaustive checklists, it's all designed to navigate extreme pressure and ensure the best possible outcome when lives literally hang in the balance. It really puts into perspective the sheer mental and practical load involved in those moments.
Indeed. And while these detailed SOPs and checklists provide such a critical framework, they also implicitly highlight the continuous, absolutely vital need for training, for mental rehearsal, and for profound adaptability.
Right.
Because no two emergencies are ever exactly alike.
Right.
And the ability to apply these standards while also recognizing when and how to deviate appropriately, mm-hmm. that's truly the hallmark of expertise in emergency medicine.
So here's a thought for you, our listeners, to carry forward. What does this meticulous standardization of emergency procedures, procedures designed for environments of utter chaos, what does that tell us about the ongoing interplay between human expertise, rapid decision-making, and the constant necessary evolution of best practices when it comes to saving lives?